So, do you have any questions or comments or anything you'd like to ask about? Yes?
Going back to comparative thinking, it's just an observation for myself, but I find it difficult to, well, because we're so, our society and our culture is so much surrounded by comparative thinking. I mean, in fact, your entire economy is based on comparative thinking. And it's so difficult to concentrate and be mindful about that.
It is, yes. And so there's a variety, you know, so it's helpful to be reflective about that, to think about it and understand that phenomenon the best we can, and then to see what you want to do about it, how to get yourself uncaught by it. And one of the ways to get uncaught is to meditate. Meditation is a very, very powerful way to get uncaught, to deconstruct some of these social constructions that we tend to live by.
Would that mean everybody becomes mindful of comparative thinking? Would that mean that society would collapse?
Well, I think the danger of that is nil. So, you know, hypothetically, you know, I suppose huge segments of our economy would just collapse. But you know who wouldn't mind? Who wouldn't notice, probably? The Amish wouldn't notice. There's all kinds of people who wouldn't notice. There are people who live quite well without it. And so, you know, maybe we'd have to be, you know, a little bit more like the Amish. Or something, you know, live much more simply. And you know, the economy is based, you know, how much of the American economy is based on consumptions of things which people don't really need. And if we just live by what we needed, it would be a whole different society. I'm actually interested in seeing that happen, so I think the chances are nil, but I think Buddhism is a very subversive religion. But the problem is not enough people, you know, live it. I was once interviewed for a radio station in San Jose, and the woman asked me, what does Buddhism have to offer to people who live this fast-paced life of Silicon Valley? And I said, well, before I answer that question, because I think it has a lot it can offer, you have to remember that Buddhism is basically subversive. That if you really took it in, the person probably wouldn't be able to live that certain kind of lifestyles. Just don't make sense. Kind of the foundation would be pulled from under, the rug would be pulled from underneath us. So, but that's an individual choice in a sense. So I kind of like it that Buddhism is subversive. But in what way it is, there's all kinds of different ways of doing that. But so anyway, but that's my point of view. And I don't really need it to be subversive. I'm just very happy that people practice, and then the practice takes them wherever it needs to go. I see the practice as being synonymous with practicing honesty. So mindfulness is a very, very high quality way of being honest about what's actually happening in the present moment. And I have my faith in honesty. You know, whatever needs to happen, whatever's going to happen, we'll be honest. I put my money there. I'll invest there. So, other thoughts or comments or questions? Yes?
You mentioned universals. Can you say a little bit more about that?
So the insights that are universal to human beings. One of them is insight into impermanence, seeing the phenomenal degree to which our life is impermanent, and that's considered to be a very important insight in Buddhism. I mean, almost all religions have insight into impermanence, but Buddhism a little bit specializes in that one because the that non-conceptual awareness of mindfulness allows us to see impermanence in a very different way than if we simply understand it conceptually. In a very, 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 very we see impermanence at a very refined level. Mindfulness allows us to. That's one of them. The other insights is insight into something which is confusing for many people at first, is this Buddhist teaching of not self. So we begin seeing the aspects of our experience which normally we take to be ourselves. We begin realizing this is actually not who I am, and that's very freeing, because we tend to be contracted around this idea, this is who I am. Yes?
Could you give an example of that, of an experience that's not who I am? I don't quite understand what you mean.
My hairline.
But I mean, it is a part of you.
Yes, but yes, it is part of me, so I'm not going to get away from that. But to judge and evaluate myself, this is who my true self is, my real self. This is how I define who I really am. My hairline in here. It's happening here, but you know, it's just that could change, right? and you know, if it changes, you know, does my true self change because of that? You know, so I mean, I see your hair color looks like it's changed over time, right? A little bit. So does your hair define who you really are? That's nice to know. There are some people in our society who think that their hair defines them, big time. None of you here, of course. So it's all these different levels, but it's also we identify with our emotions, our feelings, our opinions, our ideas, and our nationality, and our gender, and all kinds of things that we could contract it around, because this is who I really am. And when the mind stops making this movement, this is who I really am, we see this is not who I really am. So there's insight into seeing, the Buddhist insight is seeing all these things that I took as being really who I am, this is not who I am. It's very freeing, it makes you light. Yes? Yeah, so this is getting, you know, this is an intro class to just meditation. Right? And you're asking about one of the deep questions in Buddhism about the nature of self. So your question is you've heard about teaching about no self, and with what I'm talking about, insight into what is not self, is that related to not no self? And so it's fairly common for Buddhists to talk about, say that the Buddha taught there is no self. And that's very confusing once you posit there is no self. What do you mean there's no self? You know? the Buddha never said there is no self. What he said is that there's things which don't qualify as the self. And the insight into not self is always noticing, insight into seeing this is not self, this is not self, this is not self. But it's not making that leap and saying there is no self. But it's almost that, because what you see in deep practice is that nothing in our empirical world qualifies as the self. So what's left? The non-empirical world, you know? That non-empirical world from a Buddhist point of view has no relevance, because it's not something you can know. So then what about the true self? Like, how am I going to find the true self? You know? If all this is not myself, then who really am I? I need to find my true self. The Buddhist spirituality teaches that the search for the true self is an uninteresting search. Don't bother. There's better things to do with your time, like becoming free. And in order to become free, you have to let go of your attachment to all these different things being who you are. And when you no longer take anything as being who you are, then you're free. And who you are then, really? You can take a philosophy class, maybe. Now, this is confusing because many people think it's really important to find out who you are. In fact, the Buddha once, there's a famous story. The Buddha was meditating in a park, a big park. And into that park one day came these young noble men and noble women from the town, wealthy people, and they came to have a picnic in the park and frolic. And one of the noblemen didn't have a wife to bring with him. So he brought with him a local prostitute. And so they did what they do in the parks, who knows, and they picnicked. And then they all took a nap after the picnic. And when they woke up from the nap, the prostitute had disappeared with all of the jewelry. Back then, noblemen wore jewelry, lots of it, and noble women. And so these noblemen started running through the park trying to find this woman who had stolen, they assumed had stolen their jewelry. And they were going through the park and they came upon the Buddha meditating. And they said to the Buddha, "Have you seen a woman?" And the Buddha said, "What would you rather find, a woman or yourself?" And they all just sat down at his feet, and then this guy has, "Well, in terms of what's important, I think finding ourselves is more important." So there's a kind of teaching about finding yourself, but that's kind of a colloquial way of talking about self, it's a conceptual way, it's kind of big category self, you know. When you start looking very carefully, you can't find anything that really qualifies as being an essential, stable, permanent self. That's the idea in Buddhism. A self is something which is essential, permanent, and stable. There are other definitions of self besides the Buddhist one. And then part of the philosophical question is, how does that relate to the Buddhist concept of self and what Buddhism is negating? But Buddhism is negating anything which is permanent, stable, like a soul is permanent and stable, and something which you have control over, sovereignty over. You have some ability to control. And they'll say you cannot find anything that's permanent and stable or something that you can have some kind of permanent sovereignty or control over. And since you can't have any control over it, it's not permanent, then from the Buddhist definition, it's not a self. Now, some modern therapists complain about Buddhism. You know, they're spending all this time working with their clients, building their sense of self. And then their client goes to this Buddhist center and they tell, there's no self. And then it's very confusing, right? But some of the things that in therapy they're trying to do when they're trying to find the self or build up a sense of self, if you look underneath that expression, self, it's just a concept, it's a gross concept. If you look underneath that, what they're trying to do is do some of the same things that Buddhist practice is trying to do. Trying to build greater sense of awareness of motivations and beliefs and instincts and feelings and emotions. Trying to develop a certain kind of strengths of character that you need to have, integrity. So in some areas, that's called building a strong sense of self. Buddhism says, let's not use the word self. Let's just call it building a strong sense of character, for example. So I don't know if I'm being helpful. Am I being helpful at all? Or is more am I confusing you more than helping?
Oh, that's
if I'm helping and giving you a lot of questions, that's the best. That's the best. So we only have a few more minutes. Anything else that anybody would like to ask? Yes?
If you're interested in doing retreat, if you're new at meditation, how do you recommend going
to time? Yeah. I think the generic advice is build up slowly. So here at IMC we have like half day retreats. We have day long retreats on Saturday. And you know, we're so informal here that you can just come for half the day or come for a few hours and then leave. So you can just check it out, and when you feel like it's enough, you can go. So you kind of build up, and then maybe a weekend retreat, and then at some point after doing a few day long retreats like on Saturday, if you're inclined to, if you feel the desire to, you could go to a residential retreat. So we offer a couple of them every year that are weekend retreats locally. Spirit Rock offers a lot of retreats. There are 3 or 4 or 5 day retreats, and then we have 10 day retreats and things like that. So slowly build. That's kind of the generic advice. Some people, because of whatever reason, like to just jump in. And I've known people who just jumped into a 10 day silent retreat without any background. They didn't even know about meditation. They just like, well, meditation's good, I think I'll do this retreat. And sometimes there's beginner's luck. You know, it works really well. And sometimes it's better for people to do slowly. Let me say a little bit about IMC, as those of you who haven't been here before. Our center here is run what I call informally. And anybody who wants to come, finds it useful to come and practice here and be here, is more than welcome to come. Not only welcome to come, but you can consider yourself a member if you want. We don't have any membership. That's just a concept, right? But you're welcome, you know, be a member. You know, consider yourself part of the community. You become part of the community because you consider yourself that way. Or come, you know, some people will come for years and never talk to anybody, and they love it that way. And some people find sometimes it's a little bit hard to get to know people here because we sit silently together. Mm-hmm. But there's all kinds of, there are social events that happen. There's potlucks and various ways. And it tends to be a pretty friendly community if you hang out and get to know people. There's a whole range of different kinds of teachings that goes on here. So different teachers come through. And one of the values that I have for our center is that people who come here can hear a lot of different teachers, hear different voices and different kind of angles in this practice. So we have the schedule. You can see all the different activities we have. And please come as it suits you and as it fits you. Some of the events that I do, there's interviews as part of it. So you can sign up and have an interview with me if you want to talk about your practice. The Wednesday morning half-day retreats, there's interviews. And the one-day sittings on Saturday, some of them have interviews. The ones that go from 8:30 to 5, they're interviews. You generally have to come at the beginning to find space on those interview sign-up sheets. We have a group here at IMC called Dharma Friends that puts on more social events. And this coming Saturday evening from 6:30 to 10, there's a Thanksgiving vegetarian harvest potluck celebration. And if any of you like to come, and it's a nice way to get to meet people and in the community, you're welcome to come and come to that. There's flyers out there about it. There's also next Thursday is Thanksgiving, so we're closed next Thursday. So that's about us, you know, welcome. We'd love to have you come. If it's useful for you, we'd love to have you here. If it's not useful for you to be here, we don't want you here. Yes?
Did you mention that audio dharma?
Oh, audio dharma. So a lot of the teachings that happen here are recorded. So you don't have to actually come here to get the teachings. And they're recorded and then they're put on a website that's called Audio Dharma. And IMC's website has a link to it very directly. And you can listen to these talks on your computer. You can download it onto an MP3 player. There's various creative things you can do because those audio files are on the web. And I'm kind of in awe of how many talks there are there on that audio dharma. I don't know if I should be embarrassed or what I should be, but I certainly am in awe. Just in my talks, I mean, like, I didn't know I talked that much. Yeah.
Is there like a collation of it in CD-ROM form?
Is there a collation? I mean, there is some way of getting a CD-ROM form if you want. I think there's some volunteer here, like Mike Comfort, who makes them. I think this might be
information about that is on the website.
Maybe.
There's information about ordering talks on CDs. Allison
does that. That's right. Allison does CDs. And there's a way of getting tapes, too, but Allison does CDs. So there's information on the website. Contact Allison if you want a CD. Thank you, Richard. Yes?
If you just want a basic background on Buddhism,
uh-huh.
Do you have a book you could recommend?
Oh, basic background on Buddhism.
We get so, we talk about so many things, but I don't know, basic idea about the whole thing.
The whole thing? You're talking to someone who has a PhD in Buddhist studies, you know.
Yeah, a good introductory book on Buddhist studies.
There are some good books, you can go to any bookstore and kind of follow your nose to, some introductory books on Buddhism, Buddhist. But it's almost better to follow your own nose rather than get advice, because each person has their own instincts. But there's a very simple book. It's probably one of the best, maybe the best-selling book in English on Buddhism, called What the Buddha Taught, by a Sri Lankan monk named Rahula. And it's a short book. It's often used in college. It's a college textbook for introduction to Buddhism. It's very, very readable. It's kind of inspiring for a Western audience. And that's so you might try that book. Yes.
You mentioned briefly about reflection as part of Buddhism.
Yeah.
Is there a structured way of reflection?
There is. There can be. It can be done on an informal basis. You have something you want to reflect on, and you just kind of pick it up as a reflective theme. But there are also particular themes and directed themes that a person might take up in meditation practice. And sometimes on certain retreats, certain teachers will have a directed program of reflections that the person can do. One of the very common or popular reflections in Buddhism, in our tradition, is reflections on death. So there's a variety of reflections on death that can happen, and it's considered a very helpful and very significant thing to do. Maybe later you can ask me more. If you have something particular in mind behind the question. So thank you for coming to this course. I think it was lovely to have you here. And if I talk too much, I apologize. It would have been nice to have heard from you more if you had questions. Please come to IMC if it's nice for you. And also, on behalf of IMC and myself, I thank you for whatever support you provide to our center. Everything in our center is done by volunteers. Everything's done freely, and I don't get any salary. My income, my livelihood, and the support of the center, everything comes from the donations, the dana that people provide for the things we do. So thank you for whatever way you support us. Thank you.